Welcome to Kaona Stories, a program by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. I'm Hui Lee, owner of The Other Media Group, vice president of programming at Ampers, and Kaona Stories producer.
And I'm Don Eubanks, member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Indians and associate of Dandros Group.
I'm Luz Maria Frias, a happily semi-retired, loving life and exploring projects.
I love the way you say that, Luz. I'm Anthony Galloway, pastor of St. Mark AME Church in Duluth, Minnesota, and partner at the Dendros Group.
And we have a very special guest joining us today, and I'll have her introduce herself.
So happy to be here. My name is Sagal Ali. I live in St. Paul, Minnesota. I am a first-generation Somali-American refugee. I've lived in Minnesota. I've been privileged enough to call Minnesota home for the last, I want to say, 22 years. My passions are really at the intersection of equity, social justice, social impact, healthcare, and civic engagement. Those are a number of things that I feel like when you bring it together, it really embodies the things that drive me to do the work that I do. I am a senior fellow at the Atlantic Health Equity Fellowship Program, which is based in George Washington University in Washington, D.C. And I'm so excited to be here and just talk about my experiences as a Muslim as we are approaching the blessed month of Ramadan and talk all things health equity. Grateful to be here.
Thanks for coming back on the show. We had you, we had her on for our listeners, we did have her on the show previously as well to celebrate Women's History. So this is our first show, Women's History Month, and so we'll be joined all month by powerful and inspirational women. Today we have Sagal, and you know, we met a few years ago when I was looking for a community translator, and we were connected through mutual friends, and we were able to work on several projects with your father, Abdi, so I hope he's doing well. So that was really fun to be able to work with the father-daughter duo and doing these translations for different projects in the community. As we're recording this, it's just a few days before the beginning of Ramadan. So you know, I realize this is a holiday that we at Kaona Stories haven't really talked about in much detail. And so I'm hoping maybe you can tell us a little more.
Yeah, I do need to do a disclaimer that I am not a religious scholar. I am not someone who studied the religion to the point where I have a doctorate. So everything that I say, I do want to provide that disclaimer that I'm just someone who is practicing the faith and is very passionate and inspired by my religion. So as folks are listening to this, if you are a Muslim and you just hear something, you're just like, that doesn't sound right. Well, I'm just...
Thank you.
Say, Sagal, that sounds like the rest of us.
Yes. I was about to say, that sounds real familiar.
You're just like the rest of us.
And so. I'm just like grateful because I think, how do we humanize this conversation? I know we live in such a diverse, you know, world, and often religion can be a very divisive topic. So I'm just grateful to have this space to share about the things that I feel like are my favorite aspects of Ramadan. So just a 5,000 feet overview, Ramadan is a 30 days. It moves throughout the calendar. We follow the lunar calendar, I believe. And Allahu A'lam, that means only God knows. If I'm wrong, if I misspeak, please, folks have grace for me. But Ramadan, as mentioned, it is not like a stationary month. As folks prepare, as Muslims prepare for the blessed month of Ramadan, it has a number of elements. We abstain from food and water. So I think that is just normally things that people typically know. But it is from sunup to sundown. So it's not like all 30 days. People, you know, identifying quantifiable goals. So like, how often do you want to pray beyond just the five obligatory prayers? People will add more prayers. You know, what is it that you want to achieve? Do you want to learn the Quran, which is the holy book that we study? It is essentially the word of God. And it's 30 chapters. So folks tend to really focus on reading the Quran. And I would even say go as far as completing it multiple times throughout the blessed month of Ramadan. I will say that spiritual goals will differ by person. So there isn't like a cheat sheet. It really is come with your heart, try your best. I will say the last 10 days of Ramadan is the most spiritually intense, mainly because there is a night that falls on the 10 days that is, it is known to be better than 85 years, which is a lifetime. So if you worship on that night, it is as if you were worshiping for 85 years, which is great. So you'll see a lot of people go hard the last 10 days. I do want to say, if there's one thing you take away from the blessed month of Ramadan, it's not just about the abstaining from food and water. It really is God consciousness. So like you literally would leave bad habits and, you know, sins or things that, you know, might take you away from worship. You abandon those acts during the month of Ramadan. And that is most beloved to God, Allah. And we say Allah is God. And so those are things that, like, I think people don't often talk about. They just talk about the fasting from food and water, but the God consciousness is, I think, a big component that I'd want to make sure to illuminate in this discussion. So I'll pause there.
Thank you. And could you describe like the reason for the fasting?
So that actually ties back to the God consciousness. What are you willing to give up in the blessed month of Ramadan? Fasting and drinking and eating, it really is just one of those things where it's just more of, I wouldn't say like the one of the things that you give up, but it's not just the thing. You're literally pausing your worldly desires, your desire to eat, your desire to drink, your desire to maybe engage in bad habits like gossip or lying or things that I think rot at the human soul. I think food and water is just, think of it as the metaphysical, but like the internal is really the big thing. All of the things that we do is for God. It is a form of God consciousness. And just the food and water, I want to say, is just more of the physical examples of what we're giving up so that we're able to drive our kind of focus and our attention to this pleasing God and being mindful of God's presence. And I remember when I was growing up, people say, not even water. So yes, not even water, but in all fairness, we are only fasting for a set number of hours and we break our fast. When we break our fast, we break it with loved ones, family. I will acknowledge that for people who are reverting, we call it reverting to Islam. So they are now joining the religion. They tend to go through a bit more of an isolating experience. But if you are someone who is born into the religion, you will have kind of a community around you, typically your family, your neighbors. In Minneapolis, Minnesota, we have such a large, diverse Muslim population. And I think it's just an exciting time. It's people get ready by grocery shopping. They, you know, set their intentions. That's a big thing in Islam. Women, I do want to acknowledge, because it is Women's History Month, women are the backbone. They're the backbones of the dinners. And the, like, I'm telling you, people like will go all out. I'm talking like 7-course meal, and the women are in the kitchen doing this. So instead of them worshiping, right, while they're the counterparts, the men will worship, the women are in the kitchen, they're doing the caretaking on top of the worshiping. So I do want to, I know this is Women's History Month, but if you're a Muslim woman and you are listening to this, I recognize your contributions in the blessed month of Ramadan. And you know, you are the GOAT, you are the MVP. And I do encourage, if a Muslim man is listening to this, or a non-Muslim man or woman, that if you know a Muslim woman, you know, like, how do you show up for her? How do you create community support? How do we, you know, instead of putting it on the woman to do all of the cooking and the cleaning, how do we diversify those responsibilities? Because it really is kind of gender, it's gender roles that are exasperated.
Sokol, thanks so much for calling out just the importance of the role that women play and how difficult that must be, because we're taking them away from their ability to engage in the prayer and dedicate that time to themselves and their growth, but also they're cooking while they can't eat, right? And so that makes it even more difficult. So I'm so happy that you call that out.
So, Sokol, so I've been listening to this discussion of Ramadan and I'm learning a lot, but I still have to ask, Sokol, I still don't know why it's so important for your community. I mean, what is behind, what created Ramadan? there's got to be a spiritual or religious reason why this is so important.
It's as simple as this is what God wants. It's in the verse. It came down as part of the Quran. Like Ramadan marks the completion of the Quran. It is when the full Quran cover to cover came down. That's why it's so important for you to build a relationship with the Quran during the month. And in the Quran, there is a verse, God's words. This is not an interpretation. You need to, like it is Shahru Ramadan. During this blessed month, the Muslims fast. You observe fasting. And the scholars and companions of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, they kind of interpreted all of these like things of like what constitutes the fasting. And that's kind of where you get more of the direct answers, right? Like fasting from food, fasting from water, fasting from XYZ habits.
As one of the fellow people of the book, as you all call it, you know, I'm glad that you not only shared that, but explained that one of the things that we battle constantly as people of the global majority, which I'm going to start referring to us now, because all of
I
us
love that. Yes.
More of the world than our white peers. But, you know, the thing I love is when we get this specificity about the why, about why we do what we do and the intentionality behind it, it kills so much of the white animus and prejudice that seeks to try to meet us in so many different places. I mean, I think it's a lot harder to write some of these, you know, stereotypes and these just horrendous mental models that we have about each other when you get to the intentionality behind why somebody does what they do. And so that explanation, you know, I think it's really, really important for folks to understand that this isn't just something where you can only focus on how it impositions you, right? Why do we have to do X, Y, and Z? Now, I'm saying this with a fair amount of privilege, even though I don't practice white Eurocentric Christianity. You know, Christianity has a quote unquote understanding privilege, where by force, by violence, and by many other reasons that we have it in different places. And so I get that. I don't want to ignore that, you know, at all. But I have a privilege of being able to mention something and there to be a general understanding, even around non-practitioners, about loosely about, you know, what's there, even though oftentimes what we get is caricatures. And so I love that how the specificity in which and the intention in which you describe not only what we do as beyond just the food, beyond these surface markers that we may have to the deeper intent at the heart. And I'm curious for you, you know, as you go through, and I've only done it twice. I've only followed some of my Muslim friends twice to observe Ramadan with them. I didn't go as far as saying the Shahada, of course, because we have one contending fact that prevents me from doing that. But, you know, for the other pieces, we can get around. Still people in the book, right? So I get all the way to the end, and they laughing at me. Because I'm struggling, and it's beautiful, right? The intentionality, the closeness, the thing that people now pay lots of money to do, right? You could have just practiced Islam, and then you'd have had that built into your process. So I'm curious at the, you know, are there goal setting on the front end to say, like, I'm hoping that after I go through this and I get this closeness, this God focus and meditation that happens, that at the end of this year, I want to move the needle on this particular area. I'm just curious if there are things like that that are part of the process as well.
Yeah. Well, this is a great group of people. This is a very difficult, like, not topic, because I'm so happy to speak about it, but it's also nerve-wracking because I don't want to misspeak and misrepresent. So I do appreciate just like the openness of this just group of just the dynamic of this group and the conversation and how it's flowing so far. So I do want to thank you all for that. The question that you're asking is very important, because I don't think growing up, especially if you're a Muslim who grows up in the West, I promise you, like, and I don't want to generalize, but I grew up in the West and my parents just told me, you need to pray, you need to fast. What, like, you need to do all these things, right? So I'm like, okay, like, bet. Like, I just don't need to eat water, or not eat water, eat food or drink water. I just need to do that, right? Like, it took me, I'm not even joking, you guys. It literally took me until I got to my 20s to just ask myself questions that my parents, because, like, being born Muslim, I'm telling you, I don't want to say you're indoctrined, but it's like, you're just told you need to do these things, right? It takes almost like an enlightenment period that everybody goes through, like every Muslim in the West goes through, right? Like there's a path you have to take. Like you have to ask yourself, like, is this faith truly aligned to what I imagine, like I imagine it to be in my mind, right? Because you're taught things and you have to learn things that you feel like will help guide your relationship to God. And for me, growing up, I've always just been taught, this is right, this is wrong, stay away, do this, do that, like a manual. It took me in getting to my 20s to be more inquisitive and just ask, like, why am I doing this, right? Like, why am I abstaining from food and water? And like, the more that I've learned about the religion through my eyes as an adult, it's made me appreciate not only being Muslim, but also the role of God. Like what is God? How does God show up in my life? And Ramadan is the reset for every Muslim. It is, you could have gone as far away. You might've stopped praying. You might've stopped doing all of these religious practices for whatever reason, but come Ramadan, everybody has a fair chance. Everybody can just reset their souls, reset their intentions, rebuild that relationship with God. And for me, my goal vary. Like when I first started, I went in, like, I was like, I'm going to pray all the prayers on top of more prayers. So like, it was very much not personalized. Now I feel like I've kind of gone through this, like, almost like sense of evolution mentally to just say, what will make me feel closer to God? Praying, the actual physical practice of praying, or is it more just having a conversation with Him and just like telling God what my desires are and getting up in the middle of the night and like creating this dream life that I want, and then having God as like my vehicle of trying to achieve that. So like, I've had to reframe that for myself. And I think a lot of Muslims in the West are navigating a similar journey. So I will say the goals differ. I would encourage people to like make it as personalized as possible, because it really starts in here. It, like, the physical acts are great, but you really have to start in the heart. Why are you doing this? What is my goal? The goal should be to get closer to God. And then you use the acts of worship as means to achieving that. So I guess that's like the long answer.
I love it. And that right there is what the majority of Muslims around the world are engaging in. It makes it a lot harder to paint these messed up stereotypes when you understand that that's what's at the heart of what we're doing. I want to lift that up just because people be trying to craft this narrative all the kind of way. And I need folks to hear what our sister said over and over again and get these messed up movie stereotypes out your head.
I think I've talked about that a lot as well on this show. I think it's part of that refugee immigrant experience. Of like, my parents are like, this is what you do. Go do this. Go kill the chicken. You know, and I'm just like, oh, okay. You know, you're in the kitchen. Go do that. Oh, okay. Now burn this sacred paper. Oh, okay. And it wasn't until I was adult, I'm like, why are we burning this? Oh, it's spirit money. I didn't know that. You know, so it's like, it's part of this, you know, immigrant kind of thing that I think we, all of our communities just sort of end up going through, right?
In the workplace, I know I've been a CEO in a couple of different jobs, and I know there are things that we have done in honor of Ramadan and our employees. And one of them is to ensure that we don't schedule meetings around meals, right? To make it more difficult. Can you speak about that and maybe some other type of thoughtful ways to help our Muslim colleagues and friends get through it without having to feel like they're being othered by their coworkers or the institution that they work for?
A really good question. I will use kind of like my professional journey as I reflect on things that others have done for me, both at the professional level, just like even in community. When I started my career like 7 years ago, right out of college, I actually didn't know how to advocate for myself. And I was often the only person of color and or person who identified as a Muslim in the spaces that I, you know, professionally occupied. And I felt like I almost didn't even have I didn't even know I could advocate for myself. Let's start there. I didn't even know I could have conversations with my manager and say like, hey, the blessed, like, you know, Ramadan's coming up and things might look different in terms of my routine. So it took me, I would say maybe like 4 years into my career to actually like, instead of just, you know, hiding this, not even hiding, but not creating transparency to the people that I work with or the people that I share community spaces with that, you know, hey, I am fasting or, hey, you know, there are things that I might not partake in during this month. It took me 4 years to actually verbalize to people that, you know, hey, this is a very important month to me. And I do think that my spiritual journey also played a big part in it, because once I, you know, started taking, you know, my spirituality very seriously, I needed to advocate for myself in order for me to be successful, right, in the month of Ramadan. So that really helped me kind of advocate for myself 4 years into my career. I mentioned it to my manager. She was absolutely okay with it. She wanted to know, you know, how can I, do you need to start later in the day? Because at night, Muslims are in the mosques, right? In the masjids, they're praying. Like we are, I would say at night is when people do the most spiritual acts and the most praying and the most, you know, the most time that they have with their creator. And it's the most beloved time to Allah. So I think one of the things that my manager was able to help me do is, you know, say, hey, your start time will be at 10 a.m. instead of 8 a.m., right? And you might just stay later, which is worked fine for me. I also took the last 10 days off. So earlier in the conversation, I mentioned the last 10 days are the most, I think, significant days in the month. So I wanted to be able to experience that fully without distractions. So I think 6 years into my career, I decided, hey, I'm going to use my PTO to just take off that the last 10 days. So I know that I'm speaking more to the experience of me being a Muslim professional and trying to make it work for my schedule and meet the obligations, you know, that pay my livelihood. But I think in terms of if you're a boss or if you're someone who's non-Muslim and you work with Muslim people in professional spaces, you should probably check in on them and just say, you know, we know that Ramadan is coming up and you're probably, you know, juggling a lot and you might not be able to, you know, manage your work schedule, or how can I support you in this moment? I think prompting the questioning, oftentimes the weight is on the person who's, you know, fasting to actually advocate for themselves. But how are you, if you're listening to this, what can you take away and ask yourself, how do I make sure that that person, now that I know all of this information, that they have what they need, whether that's adjusting their schedule or just maybe taking on some of the work that they have on their plate, if that's something that you have capacity for. Another thing is, I think educating yourself. That's something that I would even, not even just about Ramadan, but like if you work with people and if you share space with people, educating yourself about their identities and their experiences, I think help you get ahead of it and have those conversations more openly and not feel like you might be offending someone, because you're not, you're absolutely not. If you ask somebody, you know, like, what is Ramadan and what does that look like for you? So I think just educating yourself and then having those conversations. And honestly, I will always tell you, there's never been a question that I've been asked in a curious and open way where I've ever taken it to offense. So I think people might feel that weight. I know I do when I'm engaging with someone from a different community and I want to learn more about their culture, their faith. I'm nervous that I might misspeak or I might misrepresent something that might not be accurate. So give yourself grace. I know that whoever's on the receiving end will probably be very happy that you're asking these questions. I think that's a long-winded way of me saying, you know, just know who your community are, know the people that you that share the space with, whether you're an employee or your manager, or you're just someone who constantly engages with someone who identifies as a Muslim during the month of Ramadan. I hope that answered your question.
You did a great job. You know, I think the other part of that to really emphasize is coworkers can be supportive too. I mean, if they know what your workload looks like, is, you know, don't be afraid to offer to help. Don't wait until a Muslim coworker asks you, right? Is be proactive and say, hey, I know you have this project, but I can take some of it off your hands. Or how about if we collaborate so you don't have to do as much? I mean, those acts, I think, go a long way along those lines. So thanks for your insight on that. Appreciate that.
And I will say that I did do this, and it wasn't that long ago when I did this, when Sagal and Abdi, her father, and I were working together, and I said, hey, I want to schedule this shoot, and I want to schedule it this time. And she let me know. She said, hey, it's Ramadan. We're going to be a little tired at that time. You know, can this wait a week or two? And I was like, yeah, definitely. And I just thought, I remember thinking to myself, oh, how ignorant was I to not take that into consideration, right? And this wasn't that long ago. And just being able to like teach myself that as well of like, I'm working with folks from other communities and I really shouldn't be taking this into consideration versus my deadline for the client, right? Is like, okay, these people that I'm working with and I'm friends with, like I need to better understand that. And so I thank you for telling me and letting me know at that time, like this is how, you know, we'll be really tired if we try to do this at this time. So we rescheduled it for another time. You know, I kind of want to transition over too with, you know, your faith and your sense of community and the way that you work with your father, and how we connected was through a mutual friend who also works in kind of the health equity realm, community healthcare realm, and you got this amazing fellowship. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk about this fellowship because there's a story behind this. And my religion is actually very much tied to it. My 20s was a catalyst set of years for me to get closer to God. Like I literally had to go inwards and say, like, what is it that I want from God? Like, what is the relationship I want? And obviously, like, I am a human, right? Like, I'm, you know, will fall off, come back, fall off, come back. So just keeping that in mind, I'm not a perfect Muslim, but like, I knew that the life that I wanted to live had to center God. So that was like my 20s. And like, as part of my career, I always tell people that like, my career is a testimony of what God has done in my life, because I started off as a consultant in healthcare. Mind you, before I started consulting, I loved community work. Like that was just like, I'm telling you, something about finding ways to engage with community, to identify solutions that make it work for us, like to just create space for people to just be represented and have their needs met. Like those were things that like, even as a college student, I just found passion in. And going into my career in healthcare, I knew that was very important for me, but I had to start somewhere, right? Like I knew, I just like, you know what, I'm glad to even have a job out of college. Let's start there. So like I was a consultant for like 2 years and I realized this is just not cutting it for me. Like in the sense of I wasn't finding fulfillment. It was paying the bills. I was gaining skills and I'm so grateful for that opportunity, but it really wasn't hitting at the purpose part, which is very important for me. So I prayed a lot. This is when I started building my relationship with God, I would say very early on. And I realized, I'm like, okay, God, like I want to be a vehicle of change. I really want to do good in the world, but right now I'm stuck in this, like not stuck in this role, but like, I felt almost like lost, I would say. And then I met my manager. My manager was already my manager, but there was an incredible opportunity that opened up for her and I to move over and do social responsibility. And I realized, I'm like, this is it. This is my moment to just give back to people. And I did that for 3 years, found a sense of purpose again. But then I knew once I did the 3-year mark that I had to just like figure out what's next for me. And at that point is when I started learning more about health equity. And actually, there were just things that I was noticing in terms of just like the more you research healthcare in the United States, the more you realize like, wait a minute, there's certain communities that are not doing well. Why is that? And then you realize policy is a big thing, right? Like they don't have access. Like where you live determines your health outcome. Like that to me, I remember learning that. I think I was 4 years into my career and I could not believe it. I'm like, that's redlining. There's a lot of things that create those outcomes and those conditions. And my leader at the time realized, like, you know what? I think you should go into health equity. And I'm like, what is that? And this is when health equity was an emerging topic and people were describing it. People talk about it as like value-based care, but it really is just a way of creating a healthcare system that works for everyone, irregardless of your economic back, like, you know, your socioeconomic status, irregardless of where you live. Like you should have access to care by any means. And health equity ensures that happens for everyone. So I looked into the Atlantic Health Equity Fellowship Program back in 2020. My leader at the time forwarded me the opportunity. I looked at it, mind you, no experience. I'm just a social responsibility volunteer coordinator, project manager at that point. So I applied. I didn't get into the fellowship at the time. I was so sad. And I just remember getting the rejection letter. And I was just like, I just feel like I need to keep going. Like if something told me, I'm like, I'm not going to take this no for an answer. I feel like I have something in me that is, it's a calling. So I did 2 years heads down work, building myself, getting exposure, getting into the right roles. And then I reapplied in 2022 and I got in. And I remember the Ramadan before I submitted the application. I was in the boss every day, y'all. I was in the best shit every day. I said, God, this is it, God. I did my best. I've built myself. Now I need you to open this door for me. Like if this is meant for me, literally, guys, this is a conversation during the Ramadan before I submitted the application, 30 days and nights, y'all, I was in prayer. Like I was like, I'm doing my best. I remember telling myself, I said, God, if this is for me, if I need to be in the space, open this door. If not, then make me content and just keep me going. Give me the drive to keep going. And I remember getting in, I cried, y'all. Like I remember calling my mama, calling my dad. I was like, oh my God. And they were like, you did it. And I was like, no, I didn't. Oh my God, open that door for me. Like y'all, I swear to you. I swear to God.
I love it.
And then, you know, when they tell you, when you make a prayer, get ready for that prayer. Like once that prayer is answered, you gotta be prepared. Little did I know, I don't think it's not that I didn't prepare for it. I just didn't think it was going to happen. So when it did happen, I was like, oh shoot. Like now I got to get serious. I asked, the doors open. Now I have to make this happen. It was the most life-changing experience. This fellowship brought together 19 leaders from across the world. It's a global fellowship. 400 people applied. They only chose 19.
Wow.
I know, right?
Get that word. Okay.
And then I remember getting in and I knew, I'm like, okay, this is serious. There's a responsibility that comes with this. This isn't just like an experience. I have to really learn as much as possible so that I can bring it back to my community, so that I can bring it back to the people that I want to serve. So I took this as an opportunity to grow. And the person I was when I started the fellowship and the person I became at the end of the fellowship, day and night, when I tell you this fellowship was almost imagine your life as a staircase. It was that next step that solidified not only is health equity the space I should be in, but it's also even made me reimagine my role as a leader, right? Like I didn't see myself as a leader before. This fellowship experience cemented that, no, I am a leader. I'm a servant leader. And now I'm able to identify as a servant leader because I loved serving. That's kind of where I feel like I shine when I'm working in community. Now I just have this like fellowship experience that has equipped me with the right leadership and fundamental skills to create sustainable change. And I just feel like God has been a big part in my journey. And I feel like there's a sense of responsibility in the work that I do. And I do want to create a world where everyone feels like they are. And when I say everyone, I mean like the communities that I'm a part of, the roles that I occupy, the spaces that I'm a part of. I need to be able to have the courage to speak truth to power. I need to be able to work hand in hand with the people that I serve to create solutions for them, by them. I need to be a change agent that does not sway, you know, based on popularity. Like I need to be convicted in my beliefs that everybody deserves access to care. Everybody deserves access to resources. And these are things that I feel like I owe. It's an oath that I've made to myself and God. And I feel like this fellowship experience was that it was that connector. It was that like, oh, now we're here. What happens next? And now I'm like, I don't limit myself. I used to limit myself, like what I can achieve. Like I tell myself I'm delusional with my goals, y'all. Like I'll tell myself like I'm so delusional, and not because it's not that I have confidence in my abilities as much as I have confidence in God. I'm not limiting God. When I make prayer, when I do the work, I'm so delusional that those things are going to happen because I have faith that I need to be doing this work and I need to continue to show up and God will continue to open those doors. So that's why the fellowship is so special. That Ramadan, right before I submitted the application, I want to say I did the work, but it took that Ramadan for me to pair it with faith. And I don't think I did that before with any other opportunity. So I do feel like I'm walking in my divine truth
And this fellowship is just a testament to that. I got so into my feels, y'all.
Well, you definitely, well, congratulations again on this incredible opportunity and achievement that was extremely competitive. Like you said, over 400 applicants from around the world. And clearly you're likely the only Minnesotan to have received that fellowship. And your face just lights up with energy as you speak about it. You mentioned change agent a couple of times and the importance of systemic health, you know, and the racism that most of us have seen and or experienced directly and through our family members. Can you talk about some of those systemic changes that you've been involved with, right? Either in partnership or leading, what have you been involved with? What's on the horizon for you, you know, along those lines?
Yeah. One, thank you for those kind words. I can't contain the joy that I get from telling these stories because it's one of those things where it's like, I think it's a cornerstone of my just life story, these kind of moments. So I really appreciate just your kind words. In terms of just the change agent part, a lot of the work in healthcare that I've done, at least focused on creating access. So more for my day job, I really do look at, you know, understanding social determinants of health and its relationships to health outcomes. So learning more about that. And in the fellowship, I actually looked at ways to even expand my understanding of not just social determinants of health, but personal determinants of health and commercial determinants of health. There's just so many, I think, things that influence individuals' access to care. So in terms of just like the work that I do, I would say like my focus really does center SDOH is what they call it, social determinants of health. In terms of just like the community work that I do, so I'm part of a nonprofit organization called Ayeda Leads. She leads in Somali, that's what it means. And the organization focuses on representation of African diaspora women in the civic engagement process. So not only are we working to get more African diaspora women who live in Minneapolis and Minnesota, and just even the broader metro in Minnesota, involved, right? Like at the, whether they want to run for office, we have leadership curriculum that we provide for them. We also do a lot of work in specifically for our more older immigrant communities or older refugee immigrant communities, Somali members. We have initiatives that we do for them. Right now I'm working on one and it's very near and dear to my heart for many reasons, but it's called the Dumud Project. The Domod being women, older women, or just actually women. Yeah, I think it's women. Project, it's in Somali. And we really set out to do this initiative to, one, address the increasing crisis of like the opioid addiction in the Somali community, which is tied to health, of course, as addiction, mental health go hand in hand. And as part of that, we wanted to do a peer support model where we invite mothers who might have children who are at risk or are currently experiencing addiction with opioids. We create the space for them to identify ways to navigate the system. Because I will say, having a child or having a sibling or having a loved one when you are a first generation immigrant and refugee in a newer country, and let's say the parents oftentimes they don't even speak English, it's very hard trying to find resources for your child and you feel like you're in the dark and it's a very isolating experience. So we created this almost pilot project to create that peer-to-peer support model so that, one, they understand that, you know, they're not alone and that we want to be able to help them access those resources in a timely manner. And not only that, but understand like how can we show up for them, because addiction doesn't only impact the child, but it also impacts the family, right? Like they have front row seats to watching this person's life devolve because of the addiction. So that's a project that I'm actively working on right now. In terms of just like the fellowship though, there's a lot of opportunities to work with my co-fellows and my peers. There's work right now around, you know, just like us figuring out how do we continue to collaborate across our different countries and regions, and what are those issues and topic areas that we want to stack hands on. So there's opportunities there for me to also show up as a change agent and collaborate with my brothers and sisters in the work now, because we are a family. The fellowship has brought together an incredible group of people who are just some of the most inspiring individuals. So in terms of my work as a change agent, it really, I wear a number of hats, but I will say it really just comes down to me centering the people I serve, whether that is the Somali women in my community, or just like the broader African diasporas and through the work that I'm doing with Ayala Leads, or even just understanding the role that social determinants of health plays in health outcomes and how I can pull that knowledge into the work that I do as part of my day job. And then the fellowship, looking at more of those global issues and topics that I can, work with my peers on beyond just some of the two things that I listed. So I don't know if that answered your question, but that's how I show up as a change agent for now, like as of right now.
Absolutely. Yeah. Very impressive. Thank you.
So in that, I mean, the awareness game, I think one of the challenges that I keep running into myself, and it's not like challenges as an end all, I mean, it's part of peopling, it's part of engaging, you know, with folks across the world, is you're going to run into the translation issues. You're going to run, and I'm not speaking just linguistically. I mean, culturally, I mean, the understanding and ways and how people be, and it's often a lot more difficult in our U.S. context for a whole lot of different reasons that we norm kind of rigid ways of being in ways that are much more, you know, I'll never forget traveling to South Africa and working so hard to convince my brothers and sisters that, no, I'm Black. And they're like, no, bro, here, you colored. And we're going to have a conversation about that. And so, and trying to divorce, you know, trying to nuance how I be as an American in a space where folks are like, yeah, and they refer to me as the American, right? And so that I love folks who get into that exchange work for, again, I'm gonna use that term again, for the global majority who navigates, who speaks multiple languages off the top. And so as you continue to pursue them dreams, those aspirations, those things you can't achieve, shoot for the stars, you may get the moon kind of deal. Like, are there specific areas of win and joy that you are encountering that are like, ooh, y'all, this is happening here. This thing over here is happening. This project is moving in ways that can excite folks. Cause a lot of times we get into conversations, especially when we list some of the ways in which we encounter the roadblocks, we forget to celebrate the joys.
This work isn't easy. So I want to acknowledge that. This work of being a change agent, it will break your soul because you are realizing the reality of our society, right? Like the stereotypes, the bigotry, the violence. I mean, there's just so many things that are happening in the world that you just, if you're in the work and you do change agent or you're a social change advocate or you're someone who is very passionate about creating a better world for people, it breaks you. You have to find ways to like celebrate those wins. So I think that's a very important question, especially if you're someone who does this work. I think when I first started doing this work, I thought like, okay, heads down, we're just gonna push. And then I realized, and I'm not trying to get morbid, really I'm not, but like we all have a finite time on this earth, y'all. We all have a finite time on this earth. So I switched my mentality from like all work, no celebrating because the world is still in like a grim place, right? It took me honestly doing more community-centered work away from like even just like health equity. I'm just talking about being in spaces with people that we're serving to remind myself that as we're doing this work, we also have to acknowledge the progress that has been made by many before us and where we're stepping into. And I think a lot of events as part of Ayala Leads, like when we bring together community members and we're in spaces together and people just, especially post-COVID, I will say, post-COVID, I remember we did one event, and I'll never forget, and I think this brings back to the joy. We did one event as part of Ayala Leads, and we wanted to just bring our community together. Did we think people were going to show up? No. I'm talking about, this was like maybe the
first few months, the CDC was like, okay, y'all can go back outside. And I remember we invited people like, hey, y'all pull up. But did we think people were going to show up? Not only did these people show up, they brought friends. And I remember this was part of, it was Women's History Month. It was our first event, like post-COVID. 30 people showed up. They stayed until, I think they were like, we had it in our office space and they stayed 4 hours. And I remember we were like, you ain't got to go home. You just got to leave here, you know? And people were just, they were really sad. But it was one of those moments where I looked around and I'm like, these are the moments for me personally that humanizes the work that we're doing. Like sometimes when you're doing this change agent work, you're looking at spreadsheets, you're looking at strategy, you're looking at ways to make things come together at that more programmatic level, or even if you're like in policy, more systematic level, that being in community will always heal you 10 times out of 10. Like it just makes it real that these are the people I do it for. This is the reason why I continue to show up, and it just pours back into you. And I think for me, that has been a big change from when I started this work to now, where I prioritize being in community. The work will come. The work will come, but that's when I find the most joy, when I'm with community, when I'm with my fellowship cohort and we're talking about this and we're sharing stories, when I get to know people's backgrounds and understand what's most important to them and how do we make sure that that's part of the work that we're doing and making sure that people are included. Like those are the moments that I feel like are the most joyful. Those are the moments that I will hold on to on my hardest days.
And I want to underscore that just because the point you said, this work is difficult, especially when you're trying to move the needle on something. And that every day wearing down to the soul needs replenishing. And, you know, when we're especially in diaspora in particular, since you raised that earlier, right? There's a reason that so much creativity, so much amazing human content comes out of diaspora, because that's how the body copes and connects. There's a whole lot of Quranic connections here I could make too. I mean, I'm just thinking about even the spider will weave a web to protect you from your enemies in the midst of, you know, when you are doing the right work, in life. So I thank you for bringing that forward.
Yeah, really. I mean, I think we've all felt exhausted in trying to make changes that I know I have, and you know, trying to find whatever joy that you can find is great. And I love that. Thank you. It's been so nice to have you on the show again. And, you know, of course want you back. And of course, you know, we'll see each other soon as well. Thank you so much for being on today's show. I'm Halili, owner of The Other Media Group, VP of Programming at Ampers and Counter Stories producer.
And I'm Don Eubanks, member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Indians and associate at Dendros Group.
I'm Luz Maria Frias, living life to its fullest and enjoying company like we've had today. Thank you.
And I'm Anthony Galloway, pastor of St. Mark AME Church in Duluth, Minnesota, and partner at the Dendros Group. Blessed Ramadan.
And our special guest today.
And I am Sugal. I'm going to go with community member. That's going to be my title. I'm so honored to have been invited to this and just honestly 10-10 experience. Thank you, Lee. Thank you, everyone who just made this conversation so fluid and so intentional and joyful. And to all who celebrate Ramadan Kareem, Ramadan Mubarak.
This has been Counter Stories. What's on your mind? Let us know and find us online at counterstories.com and on Facebook and Instagram. Counter Stories is a co-production of the Counter Stories crew and Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For our full conversation, please visit counterstories.com or wherever you get your podcasts.